This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For all the talk of troop levels and timetables in the president's speech last night, there was one thing missing. Any discussion of the most potent weapon he has, the American dollar. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 2nd of December. Good to have you here. Those 30,000 troops that will be going to Afghanistan are going to take all the usual military hardware with them, trucks and artillery and helicopters and Humvees. More than a few of them, though, will also have this in their backpacks, a handbook called The Commander's Guide to Money as a Weapon System. It says right there in the foreword, and this is an actual quote, that money and contracting in a counterinsurgency environment are vital elements of combat power. Dollars will be a key part of the American military strategy in Afghanistan. They will also be widely distributed as development aid. Marketplace's Steve Henn has more now on the many uses of cold hard cash.
Next year, development aid to Afghanistan will more than triple, from roughly $3 billion to more than $10 billion. That's almost half the size of Afghanistan's GDP. But Andrew Wilder, an Afghan expert at Tufts University, says the assumption that the military can use money as a weapon could easily backfire.
There's alarmingly little evidence that aid is effective in promoting our stabilization objectives or in, say, winning hearts and minds.
Wilder says right now the U.S. military evaluates some commanders on how many development projects they fund, and aid groups struggle to spend money quickly enough. But Wilder says not enough attention is paid to oversight.
We're trying to spend too much money too quickly in these insecure areas, and I think that's actually ending up fueling corruption.
And in hostile areas, enormous sums are spent on security for each new road or school project. That security's contracted out.
There's lots of anecdotal evidence of significant amounts of money being paid to the Taliban as protection money.
To provide security, yes.
Ashraf Hadari is political counselor at the Afghan embassy. Hadari says it's true, some U.S. aid ends up in Taliban hands. He acknowledges many big aid projects produce no lasting results.
Throwing more money at Afghanistan will not help resolve the situation there.
Instead of more money, Hadari and Wilder want the U.S. military to start paying closer attention to development results.
Focus should be on how do you spend that money accountably and effectively.
Wilder says smaller projects, less waste, and a slower pace are much more likely to help instead of undermine the U.S. war effort. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The House Financial Services Committee took aim at Wall Street today. The committee approved new regulations for the financial industry. This is the bill we've been telling you about, the one that allows for an audit of the Federal Reserve and lets the government take apart firms that it says are too big to fail. There is still, though, a long way to go before anything hits the president's desk on this one. Now for the latest installment in the continuing battle of paid versus unpaid, otherwise free, content on the Internet. Late last month, the News Corp chief Rupert Murdoch accused Google of making money off his content. Actually, he accused Google of stealing that content and then making money off of it. And then he threatened to pull the Wall Street Journal and some other publications he owns off of Google Search Index. Today, Google decided to play nice, kind of. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Go on Google News and you'll still be able to find stories from all kinds of sources. and you'll still get a free peek at sites, even ones that normally charge. What's new is that publishers can now limit how many times a day, five, you can click on their sites without having to register or subscribe.
So, I mean, I think that that's a very good kind of peace offering almost between Google and the newspapers.
Heather Doherty is research director at Hitwise. It studies internet users. She says Google's
showing the newspaper industry that they, you know, they do want to work with them and not, you know, disintermediate them as, you know, kind of the battle's been going on.
Some publishers, most notably Rupert Murdoch, complained Google's taking advantage of their sites by offering paid content for free. The fight over paid content online has been going on for years now. Companies have been trying to figure out what users will actually pay for. The Wall Street Journal site, which Murdoch's News Corp owns, is one of the most successful paid content sites out there. Greg Harmon is CEO of Belden Interactive, a consulting firm for news providers. He says Google's new program is yet another test of how a paid content model might work.
No one knows. Google doesn't know. Mr. Murdoch doesn't know. Nobody knows. And that's kind of the whole challenge of paid access in general is, will it work? Have no idea.
He says it's all going to shake out over the next year or two. And in the meantime, paid sites like the Wall Street Journal could get a few more subscribers. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
We told you about car sales yesterday. Detroit's Big Three did less badly than most people expected. But somehow I missed the real auto news of the day. That would be Hyundai. The Korean car maker says sales last month shot up 46%. It's building U.S. market share, too. You can add another name to the Walmart unintended victim list, GameStop. Shares fell 8.25% today after Walmart said it's cutting video game prices by $10. Yes, we have seen this before. First books, and then DVDs, and now video game prices going down. You know what the government calls it when prices go down across the economy? They call it deflation. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson looks into whether that's at play here.
Let's start by asking a Wall Street economist. Is this video game business an example of Walmart causing deflation?
No, but they certainly can be a conduit of deflation.
Chris Lowe is chief economist at FTN Financial. He says Walmart is so big, it can even affect the price of one of the main things the Fed watches to gauge the level of inflation.
During the peak in oil prices a couple of years ago, when oil got up to $170 a barrel, Walmart decided to sell gasoline below market prices to bring people into the stores. It was enough of an impact that the national average retail price of gasoline fell.
But was that Walmart causing deflation or just reacting to price-conscious consumers? Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff says it's the latter.
If we have deflation, meaning a generalized fall in prices, it certainly won't be due to the actions of any one player.
Plus, Walmart can't keep prices below market levels for long. That's according to Charles Fishman, author of The Walmart Effect.
This is what Walmart does. They lower prices. They're not saying we're slashing the prices of video games forever, any more than it turned out they were slashing the price of books forever.
So Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke doesn't need to pay too much attention to what Walmart's up to, unless, Fishman says, he's in the market for a new lawnmower.
The Fed remains a bigger deal than Walmart. The federal deficit remains a bigger deal than Walmart. And the two-thirds of the stimulus spending that hasn't actually hit the economy yet remains a bigger deal.
Although just barely, the remaining stimulus money is around $550 billion. Walmart's sales for last year, almost $400 billion. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Should you care to have it, here is a sneak peek at the November unemployment report we're going to get from the Labor Department Friday morning. ADP, the data processing company, they do a whole lot of paychecks for companies out there. They say the economy lost 169,000 jobs last month. There is a caveat here, though, and that is that sometimes there is a disconnect between what ADP says and what Uncle Sam says 2 days later. Still worth mentioning, though, traders on Wall Street today couldn't really make up their minds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The theme of the day tomorrow at the White House is going to be jobs, and then jobs, and then some more jobs. The president is hosting a big jobs summit, the goal being to figure out how to create more of them and at the same time bring the unemployment rate back down into the single digits. The president has invited members of Congress, CEOs from companies like FedEx, Google, and Boeing, not to mention a gaggle of economists and a certain former Secretary of Labor. Commentator Robert Reich offers a sneak preview of what he's going to say.
Most ideas for creating more jobs assume that jobs will return when the economy recovers. So the immediate goal is to accelerate the process. A second stimulus might be helpful in this regard if the nation could afford it. Other less expensive ideas include a new jobs tax credit for any firm creating net new jobs, lending directed at small businesses, which are having a hard time getting credit but are responsible for most new jobs, a one-year payroll tax holiday on the first, say, $20,000 of income, which would quickly put money into people's pockets. Such a holiday would also make it cheaper for businesses to hire because they pay half the payroll tax. And maybe even a WPA-style program that hires jobless workers to insulate homes. But there's reason to believe the basic assumption that jobs will eventually return when the economy recovers is wrong. Under the pressure of the Great Recession, many companies have found ways to cut their payrolls for good. They've discovered that new software and computer technologies have made workers in Asia and Latin America just about as productive as Americans, and that the Internet allows far more work to be efficiently outsourced abroad. This means many Americans won't be rehired unless they're willing to settle for much lower wages and benefits. The official unemployment numbers hide the fact that a large number of Americans already have had to accept lower pay as a condition for keeping their jobs, or have lost higher-paying jobs and are now in ones that pay less. Yet reducing unemployment by cutting wages merely exchanges one problem for another. We get jobs back, but have more people working for pay they consider inadequate, more working families at or near poverty, and widening inequality. The goal isn't just more jobs. It's more jobs with good wages, which means the fix isn't just temporary measures to accelerate a jobs recovery, but permanent new investments in the productivity of Americans.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. And here is a job for you. Let us know what you think about what you hear on the broadcast. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Our letter segment this week begins with cash. We did a story a couple of weeks ago about how more Americans are using actual money this year instead of plastic for their holiday purchases, and how that might not be such a good thing for retailers on the theory that it's more painful when you spend actual cash. Jonathan Lovelace from Milan, Michigan, wrote in to say that he can think of one upside for sellers when shoppers stay within their means.
Any money that isn't being spent on credit card interest can be spent at these retailers next year.
Brad McBride out of Freeport, Maine, took the longer view on that one. The cash purchases with the promise of future spending really isn't any good for retailers.
If you don't do something to increase earnings this quarter, right now, today, you're going to suffer the wrath of the market and could be out of business before any future benefit can be realized.
We got back into the minutiae of the financial crisis the other day in a story about how regulators are taking a closer look at interest rate swaps. They're a close cousin of the credit default swaps that brought AIG so much grief. These swaps are supposed to protect against big changes in interest rates. But municipal and nonprofit investors, everybody from county governments to universities, continue to lose billions of dollars on them. Lisa Burns is a commercial banker from Burlington, Vermont. She says the fault, dear Brutus, lies in the humans, not in the swaps.
The same people who were considered smart for reducing interest costs when the market was in their favor are now complaining that they didn't know the risks now that interest rates move against them.
Staying with human behavior now, just before Thanksgiving, we introduced you to the slow media movement. People deciding they're going to live off the electronic grid. No iPods, no cell phones, no email. Merlin Oliver from Gardnerville, Nevada, says the key to the drive for simplicity could actually be pretty simple.
Maybe it's just the difference between extroversion and introversion.
The health care bill the Senate's debating has all kinds of things tucked inside its 2,000 pages, including a 5% tax on optional cosmetic surgeries that we told you about. Deborah Johnson is a plastic surgeon in Sacramento, California. She votes no.
This is a tax that would unfairly target middle-class women. If we need additional money for government to function, we should tax our citizens equally.
A note about one other healthcare story. Monday, we looked at proton therapy and cancer treatments. We were getting at how to figure the costs of newer treatments versus the benefits that they offer. And we said there are 6 proton therapy centers in this country. There are actually 7. Also, the numbers Bob Moon and I talked about last week on the rising federal debt didn't add up for many of you. A good part of the increase in how much we owe as a country now has been because of the bank bailout and the economic stimulus package. But we should have talked about tax cuts and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. If what we say makes you mad, or if it makes you glad, you ought to let us know. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, guilt-free holidays, or tying your giving to charity.
That gives a customer the idea of, oh, okay, well, something from that gift is going to go to a good cause. Those are typically the things that we're out of first.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, not much action on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials gave back a 10%, 18 points, closed at 10,452. The NASDAQ added 0.4%, 9 points, finished at 2185. The S&P 500 basically stood still, ended the day at 1109. Worries about the outlook for banks pushed down financial shares today. Morgan Stanley unloaded nearly 3%. Wells Fargo lost close to 2%. Bank of America pulled back 1.5%. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase forfeited 0.2%. News that more American troops will be sent to Afghanistan didn't really do much for shares in defense contractors. Boeing rose a 10%. Northrop Grumman was up a fraction. General Dynamics traded down just a bit. Bonds were down as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.31%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. By Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low- to moderate-income communities. Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department releases its third quarter revised report on productivity and costs. The Senate Banking Committee discusses the nomination of Ben Bernanke to continue as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. And the National Christmas Tree Lighting Ceremony takes place in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. This recession has been global, lost jobs and lower incomes all over the world. Bad as it has been in modern economies, though, it's been worse in developing countries and war zones where people were in need even before the economy collapsed. That has made the work of charities and their donors more critical than ever.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
Our philanthropy series today has us looking overseas to a place the president was talking about just last night. In Afghanistan, millions of people are hungry and homeless, and they are jobless. Steve Henn told us up at the top of the broadcast, along with those 30,000 troops, the U.S. will be sending more aid to the region as well to push back against the Taliban and make things more stable. Author Greg Mortensen, the bestseller Three Cups of Tea was his first book, has been in and out of Afghanistan for almost 20 years, and he says the solution to Afghanistan's problem have to start with education.
Well, I grew up in Africa, Tanzania, for 15 years, and as a child, I learned a proverb that says, if we educate a boy, we educate an individual, but if we can educate a girl, we educate a community.
The organization Mortensen founded, the Central Asia Institute, has built more than 130 schools, mostly for girls, in the most remote parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan. His approach to delivering that aid and how he decides where to put the schools puts him apart from most other aid groups.
I learned both from my father and a wise old village Chief Haji Ali, you let the people make the decisions. And that's the basis of all our efforts. We provide skilled labor, materials, teacher training, but the community has to provide free land, free resources, free sweat equity, meaning 2,000 to 5,000 days of free manual labor. But they also make the decisions.
So that they have, you know, skin in the game, right?
Yeah.
Where does your group, the Central Asia Institute, get its money? Where do you get your resources?
We're a private nonprofit. 94% of our money is private. From day one, we've never taken a dime of federal money. It frees us up so that we're not perceived as an instrument of the U.S. government, so we can freely talk with the U.S. military commanders or the Taliban or anybody that we want to.
But here you are in the midst of a horrible recession and globally at that, and you have to convince people to give you money. How do you do that? What's your sales pitch?
We basically don't have any sales pitch. We try to, you know, and I've gone to marketing schools, and they say, how can you go out without asking for money? We do write about what we do. But I think the key, at least for us, is, although it might sound fairly insignificant, is children. We have a program called Pennies for Peace, and that's a program where children learn about philanthropy. They're also encouraged to do things on their own. And last year, we raised $1.4 million just from pennies.
Quantify that for me. What can $1 million do for your institute?
You could build 40 to 50 schools, and over the term of maybe 20 or 30 years, educate about 100,000 children.
Make the connection for me between education and peace.
I really think the key to peace in the world is education, but what it is it's really about ignorance and hatred. And to overcome that, what we need is education. We need tolerance.
As a guy who has spent years and years and years and years in Afghanistan, and given the level of political attention that that country is getting here today, what is your perception of how Afghanistan is doing?
Well, there's still reason to be optimistic, and there's still hope. One of the most exciting things to me has been to see the huge learning curve in the U.S. military. I was actually fairly critical. I'm a veteran, but I was fairly critical of the military in my first book, Three Cups of Tea. I called the soldiers laptop warriors because there was no boots on the ground. They were running around with their high-techy gear and really not understanding any cultural nuances. But I can say now, having been on the ground and met with thousands of servicemen, I really think that they really get it. The reason for that is a lot of the strategy now is based on, first, empowering the elders. These are the shura. These are the tribal leaders. They also are the ability to listen more. And number three, basically having more tea, building relationships with the elders.
Greg Mortensen is the founder of the Central Asia Institute. His first book was called Three Cups of Tea. His new book is called Stones into Schools. Greg, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
For all the talk of the holidays being a season of giving, of making sure that those without at least have something, in a way, this time of year often does seem to be about more just like consumption, doesn't it? The crazed shopping and the incessant advertising. Even though a lot of people are spending less this year on everything, the holidays will go on. Gifts will be bought. So retailers and charities are teaming up to make shopping itself a gift that gives more than once. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
At a Best Buy in West Los Angeles, real estate appraiser Dan Fitzpatrick is buying gifts for his friend and his girlfriend, but he's not spreading his money around like he used to.
So no, I'm definitely not spending as much money because I just don't have it.
A lot of people just don't have it this year, and those that do are holding back. It's called shopper's guilt, behavioral economist Robert Frank explains.
When there's so much in the news about families who are struggling to make ends meet, it's awkward to be seen consuming things that are not by any stretch considered necessities. People are a little embarrassed, I think, naturally.
So splurging on an Xbox for your kid or a cashmere scarf for your assistant can seem a little, well, unseemly at a time when millions of people are losing their jobs. But if part of the price of that scarf goes to feed needy children, that feels a bit better. Lynn Colley is a consumer psychology expert at the University of Oregon.
Because of the fact that there's so much guilt out there now already about overconsumption, this might be actually a very good year to use cause-related marketing.
Very good indeed. everywhere you shop these days. It seems purchases are tied to good causes. More than a quarter of retailers, from Amazon to Avon, are giving part of their holiday receipts to charity. Colley says donating 10 or 20% of a purchase to charity is a good way to get people to spend. They feel like they're making the world a better place by shopping.
Ideally, a retailer would have purchasing the product be the solution to reduce the guilt.
And shoppers don't actually have to do much of anything. Toys R Us will donate money to Toys for Tots if you just befriend Toys R Us on Facebook. Buy a gift card at Target, and St. Jude's Children's Fund gets a boost.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
With Macy's Believe campaign, feeling good is just a few pen strokes away.
Bring your letter to Santa into Macy's, and we'll donate to the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Together.
Retailers have long worked with charities, but they're stepping up those efforts this year, and they're not being quiet about it.
Well, the Good Deeds Mall is where we highlight some of their products.
Kathy Sudo is the general manager of Bloomingdale's in Los Angeles. This year, if you buy one of a dozen different items, from an $18 teddy bear to a $3,000 cappuccino maker, Bloomingdale's will give a portion of the sale to charity. A giant mural detailing this program is in every Bloomingdale's. And Sudo says it's working.
That gives a customer the idea of, oh, okay, well, something from that gift is going to go to good cause. Those are typically the things that we're out of first. So it's a good thing.
Back at Best Buy, salesperson Jackie Martinez is explaining the store's At 15 program to shopper Dan Fitzpatrick.
When you purchase this, we actually donate a portion of the money to the organization called At 15.
Okay.
Buy one of the flagged items, like Dr. Dre headphones or a DVD of Bring It On, and a portion of the purchase goes to a teen charity. Fitzpatrick says he likes the idea of a donation being tied to a purchase instead of being asked to give money at the cash register.
Being asked all the time, I feel guilty, so that's a good idea.
Martinez says customers are loving the program.
They're really happy, and they feel less guilty. It's just a warm feeling for them as well.
That warm, fuzzy feeling and a new pair of Dr. Dre headphones? Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. By Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the dollar amounts aren't up in the bank bailout or Pentagon spending categories, but there was some news out of the National Institutes of Health this afternoon. The NIH has approved the first experiments by federally funded scientists using new lines of human embryonic stem cells, $21 million in research grants. President Obama lifted 8-year-old restrictions on that type of work this past spring. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow shed 18 points, about a 10th percent. The Nasdaq edged up 9 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 didn't really budge at all. It stayed pretty much flat, ending the day at 1,109. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this broadcast, when you think you're supporting that needy child overseas, but really, you're not.
The big problem with donor illusion is, of course, that plenty of people don't read the fine print. And when they find out the way things really work, they feel lied to or misled.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.